bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, welcome to the Photo Show from the British Tech Network. My name's Ian Rankin, and I'm joined by Alex Fox. It's a simple lineup this week. There's me and there's him. See? And I can pick his nose, look. How you doing, mate?
I'm all right. A very simple lineup. You don't get more simple than us two.
You don't, no. Two pro photographers here to discuss photo news. Not much that there is that's of any real note or pleasantness. And then we're going to take your questions. So, chat room, if you've got any questions, then fire away. But we've got three in the dock ready to go anyway. Right. Shall we start? Biggest news here in the UK, which I think would be it's quite exasperating actually, is that Jessops is in a lot of trouble, which is like a high street retailer of camera equipment over here. They're usually pretty competitive. They do an online price matching process, but they've been struggling, it would seem, with sales. And there's a talk about £35 million being put in by Canon to try and support them and get them moved along. One of the problems that we get with photo shops over in the UK, which I'm sure you probably get in other countries as well, is the fact that you tend to get pushed. The deal of the week seems to be what the camera shop wants to sell you rather than it necessarily being whatever's the best camera for the job that you've spec'd up. Any thoughts, Alex, on Jessops as a whole before we go into why they're crap, need supporting?
Well, Jessops is a home, and I bought something from Jessops recently, partly because of I knew they were in trouble and I needed something, and I thought I'll share out what I've got. It's not a lot, but I'll share it out. And so I went there. Jessops, they have got years ago, if you went to Jessops, and it's nothing to do with anyone personally, but there was a good chance you'd speak to somebody that had some inkling, and most of them were frustrated photographers.
There was or geeks.
People. Yeah, but you'd have people that had got a degree in photography and couldn't get a job in the industry, and they'd go to work for Jessops. So you'd be speaking to someone that had a passion for the subject and a knowledge for the subject, and quite often you couldn't get out there for an hour because they wanted to know what you did and how you did it and who you worked with, because they were really interested. The last time I went to Jessops, I'd pre-ordered and everything, and I went to pick it up and everything, and I was literally handed something over a counter and given a receipt. And it was a very, very different experience, and I sort of couldn't make conversation. I heard him over talking to a customer who was asking him some questions, and he was doing the just basically reading back what was on the label in front of him to the lady who could probably read it for herself. So I think what Jessops was, I mean, there might be, I mean, I'm sure there's loads of wonderful people there still, but the only experience I've had recently was a very different experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time since I bought a camera from Jessops, a very long time, 20 years maybe. In the last 10, certainly, all I've ever bought from is Wex or Calumet. And the one thing I do set as my rule is if I go and use a shop to try and find out what the camera's like, I will at least enter into a heated debate with them about why they should sell it me for nearly the same price as the online price. You know, I feel some kind of loyalty to the fact that they've let me have a play or they've let me stick a flash card in and get a picture to bring back and analyse. Jessops have kind of lost that ability. I remember talking to a guy a while ago and saying, go in, you know, take a card, they'll let you take a picture. And he came back and said, they wouldn't let me touch the camera apart from just hold it and look at it. And when I said, can I put a card in and take a picture? They said, oh, no, you can't do that. So why? And he said, I don't know. I think someone was talking about viruses or something. I'm like, for God's sake. So,
virus, if you handle it and don't clean your hands after sneezing, than you would from putting a card in it.
Exactly. That's the thing. So Canon are going to shove £34 million in. I mean, are they just propping up a punctured lifeboat here?
No, I think it's a brilliant strategy. I really do. Because we've talked endlessly to the point where people are sick of us talking about Nikon and Canon. And for that reason, I'm grateful. We've talked about the fact that Nikon has got such a big jump on Canon at the moment. Now, I imagine if Canon throws in X amount of millions of pounds into Jessops, the only chain retailer of photography in this country, it's going to be a preferential sway to them, you know, having special offers on Canon. And when you come in and want a DSLR, they'll obviously stock other cameras, but there's going to be a big show of Canon. Canon are going to get a preferential when you go and say, what's the difference to these two cameras? I think the salesperson may bend you slightly towards Canon. And there's nothing wrong with that if Canon have paid for it. And £35 million is some incredibly cheap advertising.
Well, it is if it's a Canon shop. But, I mean, is there any suggestion that they're going to change front-end banding here, or is it still going to be Jessop's and they're just silent partner retailers, that kind of stuff?
Ed, if you give the impression of being an independent and still lean towards Canon, better deal than having an actual Canon shop. Because if you go into a Canon shop, it's because you want a Canon. If you go into a Jessop's, it's because you don't necessarily know what you want. That's the difference.
And everyone that fancies any Nikon stuff is going to walk away from any Canon shop. So your other sales will go down to peripheral equipment, so lighting, which is non-brand specific, and umbrellas and what's left of film and flash guns and all those kind of things are going to wane as well. So you've got to keep that market open.
Anything that would happen if Jessop's went under is people would have to listen to us more to get some opinion.
Well, which is they should be doing anyway. Yeah, absolutely. True. Photographers here in the UK are going mad for Leica, allegedly. Leica have produced an M9P camera kit that's up to and including £36,000. It's a specialist version that comes with a calf skin leather finish on the body, and there's a lens kit that comes with it. It already comes with a 50mm f1.4 Simulix, which has got good reviews as a good lens. But if you buy all the other lens with it as well, there's only 100 sets and it comes to £36,000. Any thoughts?
There may have been a time where I would have thought, oh, that's a good idea. Not that I'd have the money, but I'd have even thought it. I mean, these Leica cameras, they're lovely bits of kit. They're not £36,000 piece of kit, but 100 of them, I think you could probably find enough wealthy people to buy 100 of these things. I mean, some of my customers, a lot of my customers, wouldn't think twice about, I can't think what to buy my husband for a birthday present. He hasn't got one of them. It's only 36,000. We'll get one. He likes cameras. So it's only 100 of them. The fact that they're going to leave the shelves quite quickly, it's nothing. I mean, I know people spend £10 million on a whim on a painting because they want to see if they like it. And there's more than 100 of people that would spend that on a painting, so it's not a lot of money to them. If they were doing that as and wanted to sell 10,000 of them, I think they might have had a problem, but not 100 of them.
No, I think there's a comment from Russ in the chat room. I did have a Leica once, but I got so angry with it that I threw it at my Ferrari.
Exactly.
Leica have got some. I can't believe that Leica are sustaining a business model on what they're currently doing. They take great pictures. They're nice cameras, but they aren't four times more expensive than the closest rival, and they certainly aren't £10,000 cameras. When you look at the fact that now Hasselblad has dropped a lot of its range, and you can start picking up the 30 megapixel Hasselblads at £9,000.
That's something else, isn't it? But Leica, this isn't a business model for Leica, is it? This is their, I don't know, this is their bejeweled iPhone case for £20,000 with diamonds on it thing. This isn't what they do. They make reasonable lenses that go in Panasonics. That's where they...
I'm glad you said that.
But it's true. Leica's income comes from the stuff they make that go in other people's products. This is their... I can't think of... There's enough car companies that don't make an awful lot of money on their cars. They make a lot of money on making the bits that go for manufacturers' cars, you know? It's the way it works. But, you know, you want a prestigious brand, the best thing to do is make 100 of something that's worth 2,000 quid and charge 36,000. Because of that gives you the name. And that means when you buy a Panasonic, because it says, oh, I'd say Panasonic, I'm sure it is Panasonic, that has a Leica badge on the lens, people will assume, quite rightly, though, that they're good lenses. Mm. It's a branding thing. It's Canon buying into Jessop's. It's a branding thing. And it, again, it's a cheap branding thing.
The I mean, Russ in the chat room again saying, I thought Leicas were only being bought really as a status symbol more than anything else, and that's probably true. And some of the camera snobs as well. Prestige only, says Nitro.
Very true, and I won't tell you that I've got one.
Oh, you've got one of everything, mate.
Maybe.
Snapseed is free. If you want the iOS version of Snapseed anyway, if you want the Mac version, you're going to have to go and buy the £13.99 Mac App Store one that's out there. But for this week, certainly, Snapseed is available free of charge for your iPhone and your iPad. Had a play?
Yeah, I've had Snapseed for ages when I bought it.
When you paid £5 for it.
Well, the thing is, Snapseed was one of the first ones to do it properly. And now you've got Instagram going to go, you know, it's pretty viral now, but it's going to get bigger. You've got Facebook knocking out an Instagram version, if you like, for free. You've got Photoshop for free. They made all the money they were going to make by releasing it early and selling it. Nobody is going to carry on buying these apps because there's too many similar things to choose from that you don't need to pay for. They're doing the right thing. You get them hooked on Snapseed for free now, and then they go and spend £13 or whatever it is on the desktop version. So, you know, it makes sense to me. But as a program, I really like Snapseed. It was the first one, or it was the only one that I sort of played with and thought, you know what, it's not degrading the image to a point where I don't recognize it as my image anymore.
Yeah.
It's a nice tool. So, you know, I'm glad it's gone free. I'm not glad that I paid to help it go free, but I don't see they've got any choice. But it's a really good bit of software. So if you don't have it, get it.
We've got some instant reviews in the chat room here. Super Chicken saying, too fiddly on the iPhone, but absolutely great on the iPad. Paulum says, actually, I prefer it to the Facebook-owned app, of which I shall not speak. I think, I don't know why, but that's Instagram I'm taking. Definitely better than Instagram. Way, way better than Instagram. Far more flexibility. And Russ is chiming back in on the Leica, saying, I walked around the Chelsea Flower Show last week. I now feel very important that I had a Leica-equipped Panasonic TZ10.
Yeah, you're all posh.
Yeah, Snapseed's a good buy. I say it's $13.99 UK price. It's $20 if you want to buy it in the Mac App Store. And at that price, it's a very good application. I mean, £13 for a photo editor that's relatively good. It's still a bit. It's a bit click and play, but not horrific. Certainly, you know,
click and play without doing too much damage. Though some of these other click and it's irrelevant what picture you took in the first place, to be honest. But so much on top of it, it's like, what was it? What did it start off being? You know, so I like it. I always did like it. So good luck.
It was $4.99 if you want the iOS version. But as far as I'm aware, the Mac App Store version has always been $13.99. So
good.
Last story. Pentax are creating a 360-degree camera, allegedly. It's a rumour. We have to stress here, but they're supposedly going to come out with a camera that does 360-degree panoramic shots.
Okay.
Why?
One shot?
I don't know. I mean, have you always wanted to take a picture of the back of your head?
Well, I don't think it would necessarily. The only panoramic 360 things I ever used were years ago, and I hate to use the word indoor architectural shots, but they were indoor architectural shots, and they were on a tripod, and they were on the camera used to whiz round, basically. It used to whiz round the tripod, and the film used to, it was great long lengths of film, and it was almost like a video camera, and it used to just go round on the tripod.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it basically exposed it that way. I dare say with digital cameras, you could probably have an inbuilt swivel, or, you know, electronic timed spin, so it sat on its own mount and it went round in a circle. So I don't imagine you could actually take a picture of the back of your head. And
I was being facetious before anyone writes in with a comment.
Write in, be rude. Join the
queue.
So do you know what? I mean, the example they've done here is of a beach. I can't really work out how that's 360.
It's not.
you know, it doesn't seem to work, that particular image. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. There is a joy of stitching together a 360 panoramic by yourself.
Only if it works. There's no joy in it if it doesn't.
Something I mentioned a few weeks ago, it might not have been on this show, that I bought a panoramic stitching program. I think I only paid about $5 for it as part of a package. And it was 10 times quicker, and it was so much better than the Photoshop version. So one of them's £800, and one of them cost me about $5, and the $5 one was better.
Yeah.
It's good fun taking panoramics. You know, you sort of learn to do it and make your life slightly easier. But, you know, with the corrections that it does for you, it's good fun. I'm not sure why you need a 360 camera to do it, but I suppose if you want to do it on a professional basis, a camera might help.
Chat room again is chiming in with some fabulous comments. Oh, great, a camera that produces a photo that you're always in. Nitro says, I took up photography so that I wouldn't be in the pictures. And he also says, do I have to lay on the ground to make sure I'm not in the picture? Maybe. I'll have to wait and see.
Hat-mounted version.
There's some other stories this week, but they're all really boring, or I can't be bothered, or I don't understand them, so we'll move on. We've got six things, our regular feature, where six things are requested of us, and we give you our top tips for dealing with that situation. This week's has been sent in, and it's anonymously, it has to be said, that's why I'm giving you a name. But the question is, with the early mornings and late evenings available, what are the six tips for bird watching? Tricks, tools, recommendations for shooting feathered friends. Obviously not in a Dirty Harry kind of way. Go on, mate, start us off with one or...
Well, first thing I'd say is don't have my cat.
No cats.
Since the family decided to get that cat, there's no birds below 20 foot in my garden ever.
Is that height, as it or off the ground?
Big, so the cat can't get them. Right, first thing, I mean, I've done it. One of the things I do, quite obviously, is I shoot from indoors because of with a decent length lens and darkness behind you. If you're not shooting a bird that's right in front of the window, you'd be amazed how little distortion or how little dirt or dust or whatever appears in the picture. A lot of people want to get outside and they want to, you know, stand in front of the bird. But even if you're hidden away nicely in a makeshift hide or something, just a click of your shutter and they're gone. If you can, shoot from indoors. I used to do it when I was younger. I used to do a lot of that, and I used to shoot from my dad's shed. So I don't know why they didn't seem to notice me if I was in the shed. Even sometimes with the shed windows open, they didn't notice me. So, and also, if you do it during the day where it's actually noisier anyway, if there's more, is the word ambient, if there's more ambient noise around you, it doesn't seem to disturb them so much. So that's a trick.
Good one. My trick would be, if you just to add into what Alex is saying there, this is where your lens hood really works. If you put your camera up close to the glass, if you put your lens hood on and just try and get that last bit of space that you've got between the glass and the lens occupied with something that's dark and black, or even if you put a bit of sugar paper around and tape it on, that'll help. Get a very specific cone going right up to the glass as best as you can. Stop light coming across the front of the lens there. That'll cause an obstruction issue. The other one, the chat room's going mad with not the squeaky toy. So thank you, everyone. Mine would be to shoot on shutter priority rather than anything else. Don't go for manual. Don't go for the P. Don't go for aperture priority. Yes, your depth of field is going to be important to you, but more often than not, if you're trying to shoot pretty quickly anyway, your camera's going to look for that low f-stop setting regardless. But certain birds, particularly things like blue tits or finches, those kind of things, I mean, they are blisteringly fast. And unless you're shooting at a minimum, I would say at 1/800th to 1/1000th of a second, they're going to be a blurb. Even if you're shooting remotely, I had... a remote trigger set up to shoot a bird box that had got bird tits coming, blue tits coming up to it. and I got it suspended on the underside of a tree. I'd focused it already, so there was no focusing required. So when I shot the remote trigger, it was just releasing the shutter, and I had it at 1/1000th, and even then, I still had blue tits that were already away from the box reacting to the sound of the camera before 1/1000th of a second had gone. I've got no idea how, because theoretically it should be physically impossible, but they are fast little suckers. So shoot and shutter priority and try and get the fastest exposure you possibly can. There you go.
Here you go. Here's one that's going to be shot down in flames. Just to come back on the point you just made, and it's got nothing to do with photography. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I remember reading that certain birds, they see things. You know that we talk about frames per second when we're talking about film?
Yeah.
Say we see things at, what do we, it's about what the TV does, and that's why the TV's where it is. So it's about 30 frames per second. I think pigeons are about 500 frames a second. It's like, you know when you drive towards a pigeon and you think, there's no way that bird's going to get out of the way. Well, to them, the last minute or the last moment is a lot, you know, closer than you think it is, because their frame rate is so much faster. And that's why your bird is away before you even press the button. Because of, you know, you're at 30 frames a second and they're at 500 frames a second. It's got nothing to do with photography. It's just something I happen to have read.
If you watch the last 5 to 10 minutes of the animated cartoon Over the Hedge with Bruce Willis doing the voice of the raccoon, there's a bit in there with the squirrel, and that's what life's like for tiny creatures. Everything else is magically slowed down in comparison. I agree entirely, Alex.
Right, what would I do? Tethered shooting is always good fun. You can do it with Nikons. I mean, you can do it with Nikons with a free piece of software called, I think it's Softbild, which is Sofbild. I think it's a Dutch company. It's a free download, and it works on most Nikon cameras via USB, which means you can sit indoors with a laptop and a really long USB lead, and you can have live view, and you can shoot. That's quite nice, but you've got to remember that, in general, if you have shot something like a bird table, you're not going to get very many shots before they bugger off. You could do that sort of thing with a camera side on live view and have, you know, like a 300 or 400 mil lens. And again, if there's enough ambient noise, they might not be hearing the click. It might not disturb them. But also, things like cameras, if you're going to sit outside and you are going to use a tripod, leave the tripod out there a couple of hours before you go out, especially with birds, because of once they've been there and they've eaten off the table a couple of times and they've already seen the tripod there for the last two or three times they've done it, they're not going to be freaked out by it. I know, again, that's not a technical, but it is about bird watching and taking pictures of birds. You need to leave your stuff there. Is even if you've got a hide, don't set up your hide just to go and take that picture. Set up your hide and leave it for the birds to get used to it. Then go and get in your hide. You can't just put anything out there. Their memories are incredible. It's all visual. And if something changes, they won't go out. So set things up early, leave it for a couple of hours, then go out and try and use it.
Good one. I'd thought of a really cracking one then, but I've forgotten it now.
It as well, isn't it?
It was a good one. The other one that I thought of was shoot from above, because although you haven't got the same kind of problem, like a lot of animals like sheep and so on, getting above them, they're stupid. They'll wander right up to where you're at because they just have no concept of things that are above the headline if it's a four-legged animal. Birds are far better than that. But equally, if you've got a surface where you've laid out your lure, then raise that surface as high as you can, because they'll always look for other surfaces around from which cats can pounce and that kind of thing. So the higher and flatter are they up, the safer they feel. And if you get yourself high up in a bedroom window, or you can get yourself on a ledge or a plateau and look down on the bird, then you'll find yourself far easier to catch them. But obviously your picture's going to change because of that. And the other thing I thought of as well is, if it's money, no object, get yourself a very long, very fast lens.
Or if you're really into it, hire it.
Yeah, good point.
You're not going to go shooting birds every day of the week. And have a go. If there's a certain bird you're interested in, something that's really good, go and hire a lens. Weekend rates for hiring lenses are great, because they charge you for one day. So you can have it on a Friday and quite often even take it back on a Tuesday. So you get 4 days for the price of one. So if you're going to hire for weekends, it's an awful lot cheaper. We pay for the cost by hiring it during the week. So the amateurs can get it for a lot cheaper for the weekend, and that's how it works.
I would also say go to the RSPB website, the Royal Society for Protection of Birds, because there's a ton of information about birds there, and they'll tell you where their habitats are. So if there's a type of bird that you want to shoot, then do your homework beforehand and find out where they're likely to be. You're going to be more successful at getting pictures of birds if you know where the birds are going to be, rather than just going out on spec and sitting by a lake and seeing what shows up.
One last thing. Again, it's bird watching, but it's not strict photography. A few years ago, I've got some ivy growing up by the house and down the side of the house and various things. The same birds nested there year after year until we got the cat, obviously. But what I did is I put in a fairly cheap webcam inside the ivy. I pointed it down. I left it there for a while, as I said, let the birds get used to it. And I had about three extensions of USB. So it was about 20 foot, which is about the limit it could take. And we had a laptop on the kitchen table, day and night. It wasn't a problem. We just watched these birds in the nest, and it was amazing. Just set it up. And if you've got little kids, they are mesmerized by watching the mother coming in, or father, because both of them feed the birds. So do think about it, because I reckon I paid £5 for the webcam. You know, if it really got soaked, I'm sure it would have packed up. But it just so happened it wet, but it wasn't a problem. And I just stuck it on top of the nest in the ivy, no problem. And we watched these birds for a couple of weeks, and they fledged. It was brilliant. But it was a really nice family experience that cost us virtually nothing. So do bear in mind that, you know, it's not photography as such, but if you've got young kids, it's a wonderful thing to show them.
Pete in the chat room has said, I've been to the RSPCA today. I couldn't get over how tiny their offices were. Not enough room to swing a cat. Well done, Pete. That's quip of the day. I think we got the title.
I want to know what you're going to pull out of that sentence.
We'll think of something. Questions. Question one. Hi, guys. Love the show. I'm still learning my way in the DSLR realm, and I was wondering if you could explain how I can work out what ISO I should be using in any given time. I know you might have covered this subject before, but would greatly appreciate any lay advice you could give me. Thanks in advance, John Finch of London. There was some tips that have come out today from Digital Rev, and one of the things in there is it says use auto ISO. Auto ISO is your friend. There's a lot of good stuff in that video, but that's not one of them. Do not use auto ISO. Crank up your ISO, I would say, if you're in low light, but don't just instantly let the camera pick everything. Alex, anything anything to add to John's question there?
Well, the basics of ISO, you've got all the balances between, ISO, shutter speed and aperture, you've got, and basically the amount of light that's in the room as well. You've got all them, but basically what ISO does, it's the same as ASA was in the old days. You've got different speeds that the sensor will be, what's the word I'm looking for? Sensitive to, if that's the right word, because I'm thinking of film.
Yeah.
The faster, therefore, the more sensitive you make the sensor, the more grain, the more noise that you get on your image, which is exactly the same as it was with film. I myself, when I'm shooting for work, because I work in the arts, I've got full control over light, and if I haven't got full control over light, I've got full control over the length of exposure, because what I shoot doesn't move. So I tend to go down to 100 or 200, which gives me the best, it's basically what a camera is set for. It's what the sensor was built for. So I go down as low as I possibly can. With the newer Nikons and some of the new cameras and Canon and various people, and yeah, I know it's Nikon and Canon only, but they're what I use. You can go up to 1,000, you can go up to, I've seen sort of 1,600, I've seen, 8,000 and things, and the grain isn't too bad. So if you are indoors, you can slightly ignore the fact that you're indoors these days, which you never used to be able to do. So basically, the more light you've got, go bring your ISO to as low as you possibly can. But some people use high ISOs because they want the grain. They want the noise in the picture, and they don't want to artificially add it later. For things like black and white photography, I always use a high ISO because with digital film, it looks digital cameras. To me, it looks too clean at a low ISO. It doesn't look right because of in the old days with the silver nitrate and stuff in the film, and there was a different feel to a picture. So I tend to use a faster ISO with black and white. But I mean, I don't mean to confuse the issue. The basics are, if you've got a lot of light, use a low ISO. If you don't have a lot of light, use a higher ISO. And then it depends what you're shooting, whether you do a priority or aperture or speed. But I mean, that's the very basics of it.
I think one of the things that I come across with amateurs that I do get to talk to is that they have a tendency to believe that ISO is purely about speed and nothing else. And yes, it is about capture speed. It's the way that the medium or the speed at which the medium actually gathers the information of the light that's coming through the lens. But you've got to bear in mind there's a payoff to that, and the payoff to that is quality. And quality before was quality in terms of the fact that the grain would increase. But if you had a black and white film, you only ever got black and white results. So you'd buy a 1600 ISO black and white film because what you would want there is a very high grain, but it would be always black and white. Well, the problem is now you're shooting colour on digital all the time, then turning to black and white. The colour will put a lot of aberrations on there for colour aberration as well, which you never used to get as badly on film at higher ISOs. So it's a huge amount about quality. Yes, you're trading off speed for quality in what you do. If you can shoot at ISO 100, you'll get very, very clear films. And if you want to muck them up, then you can shove them through an analog app or Instagram or something afterwards and put grain in them or aberrations. But it's not just, ISO is not just about speed. Bear that in mind.
So now we go, just to relate it back to what we talked about with the bird watching, there will be instances where you're talking about shooting something at 1,000th a second. If you want the aperture to be a certain aperture, maybe for the sharpest point of your lens or something, it might be an idea, if you're outdoors and there's a good enough light supply, to turn your ISO up so you can reduce or turn the aperture up as well. You know, change your depth of field by using the ISO to compensate for the aperture. Oh man, I know it sounds like we're complicating the issue, but there are other uses of ISO because
Hang on, Alex. I mean, that's the point, is that the photography is the balance of those three things, the shutter,
I'm just learning DSLR. I thought, am I complicating the issue far too much there? But yeah.
Well,
it is. It's a wonderful tool if you use it correctly.
Yeah, but equally, I agree with you, but equally, lesson one is understand what is ISO, what is aperture, what is shutter priority. That's your three keys.
I agree.
Question two. Hi, gents. Love the show. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much, Rob. What is meant by colour balance within an image? I'm an amateur through and through and have heard the term for years, but the other week whilst listening to the show, I thought about it and realised I never really understood it. Thank you. Rob Loudon of Cambridge.
Yes, my subject. I specialise in the reproduction of colour and not any colour, the reproduction of the correct colour. And that's why, believe it or not, people pay me to take photographs. Colour balance is, it matters just as much with film as it did with digital. In fact, it mattered far more with film because it was an awful lot harder to correct it afterwards. But when you use a digital camera, which is foremost what we're talking about here, well, you don't actually have to tell it at source if you're shooting raw, but if you're shooting something other than raw, you need to tell the camera what colour the light is that you're using. Daylight is blue. Flash is blue, but it's a slightly different blue. I shoot in tungsten, which is orange. You get yellows, you get greens, there's different lights. Your brain doesn't see these colours unless you're comparing them with something else. But every light source that we use has a different colour. So the camera sees all these color balances. The trick is, if you shoot a white piece of paper and you've got the incorrect color balance set on your camera, you'll put it on your computer and it will be bright blue. It will be bright orange. It will be bright green. It will be various colors, and you won't believe how far out these colors can be. And so on its most basic setting, what you're trying to do is tell it what the light source color is. You can do that in Kelvin, which is the scale in numbers from, I don't know what it starts off, about 1,000, doesn't it? Goes up to about 8,000. And that's, if you like, that's a rainbow, but it's stepped in number increments. So you go from one end of it to the other end of it, but you get different colors along there. And you just have to tell it, is it daylight? Is it tungsten? Is it fluorescent? Is it, you know, there's loads of different types. To take it a stage further, once you've got that right, then what you've got to do is every camera, every individual camera, as well as every camera make, shoots colors and it sees colors ever so slightly differently, just like a computer screen does. And what I use is color cards, which have 24, some of them got 144. They've got different colors on the cards, and I've got computer software that if I shoot one of these cards, the computer can read the percentage of correction it needs for each color and still keep each color correct. Then you get to the point where you set up a color space for that camera on that day, because of the camera gets older and the light is slightly different. The lens you use corrects changes the color very. I mean, they are very, very subtle differences. But when people are paying you because of you're supposed to get this color right, there's a multitude of things that can change the color, hardware, lights, and everything. But you know, that's going to the nth degree. But just as a basic setting, nearly all cameras have. You can shoot what's known as a white balance. You can shoot a bit of card. The camera will read that bit of card, notice what color the camera is reading off of that card, and correct for it. Having said all that, if you're shooting RAW, you can correct it. Not even correct it. After you've shot in RAW, you tell it what the color balance was afterwards, and that means you can do whatever you like with the picture. But I think that's a sort of, that's all I can tell you very quickly about color balance.
Yeah, I mean, that's a the chat room saying, is this mastermind? Well done, Alex. I think one of the things that if you're talking about within an image, from what you're saying there, I'll get your name right, Rob. This is an image that I've just quickly got off the net while Alex was talking. I had more time than I'd realised. But it's got what you do here is someone who's outside taking a picture of an internal image at dusk. And you can clearly see one end of the bench is very, very yellow and the other end of the bench is very, very blue. Now, if you look at contrast within an image, you want white whites and black blacks. And that way you'll get a good spread of tones across the black and white spectrum. If you're talking about colours, you want red reds, green greens and blue blues. Well, if you're shooting in an environment where the light that's being provided to you is mixed, so here you've got the internal light that's coming through is yellow and the external light that's provided by the sun and the reflection off the sea creating the blue sky is blue, getting a colour balance between those two is, Alex, correct me if I'm wrong here, because you are the specialist on this for sure, but I would say impossible.
Yeah, the only thing you can do is actually mask out various parts of the picture and do a colour balance for each section.
Yeah, which would then look unnatural, which is kind of where...
What I do with that is exactly what the photographer has done here, is the majority of the picture that you want to get the right colour of is internal white. So he's gone with the internal colour and he's let the external colour take care of itself, because it's how your brain would see it anyway. He's done the right thing with this picture.
Yeah, but if you're in a single light-sourced environment, like you're outside constantly or part of that image and you're constantly inside with another image and you're getting predominantly yellow light, then the goal that you should have here, Rob, is to get red reds, greens greens and blue blues, and not to try and get those as aberrations of each other so that they don't balance well within the image and the image looks too green, too red, too blue.
I agree.
There you go. Two different parts to the same answer, like that one.
Because I think I hogged the middle one.
No, spot on, mate. Great answer. People will be playing that back in years to come.
I'm confident.
Well done. And you heard it here. Dear Carl, Chris, you and Alex, much as I love Missy, I want to get more into controlling my camera and wondered if you had any tips for getting from P to M. Do I need to go through AV or TV, or can I get there by teleporting straight to M? Regards, Mark Chapman, Eastleigh. Great question.
Yeah, I find it difficult because you'd have to go from the alphabet backwards, wouldn't you? Yes. You'd have to go...
LMN.
It's hot. Yeah. Anyway, do I need to... Oh, it's got all these sort of Canon things, AV and TV. I don't understand any of those.
Aperture priority and shutter priority.
E for shutter.
I don't know. It just frigging is, all right.
There you go. I sort of guessed, the aperture bit with an A. I don't know. It gave it away. But TV, I was thinking it's either the television setting or it's for people that wear the wrong gender clothing.
Are you going to bother answering the question or not?
Okay. What would I do from going? Let's start off with, if you want to do it, go from, pick one thing at a time. If you want to go from completely auto to completely manual, don't try and do it in one step. Pick one thing at a time. Shutter, it's fairly obvious. If you've got something that's moving fast and you want to make it sound like it's not moving, sound look like it's not moving fast, then turn up, go to shutter priority, turn up your shutter speed, and stop that movement within the image. If you want to worry about the depth of field over anything else, which you'd need, quite often you want to do with static objects because you either want to bring in the background or lose the background, then go to aperture priority. But if you want to go fully manual, I would learn what the effects of the various priorities are first. One of the things you can do, though, is if you go to anything other than fully programmed, say aperture, for instance, just as you're about to press it, you'll get all the numbers on the screen, which is relevant to all the other settings, speed and ISO and aperture and things, right? And you can enter them in manually and then just tweak the manual settings a little bit and see what changes in your image. And you can learn that way, but actually get the readings from the camera on automatic, transfer them by manually to manual, and then just tweak them. And that's probably the best way to learn what does what for you best. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, good tip. I would agree. I think I think going through the AV and TV is a very good idea, as in see what is being influenced by what, where you point it. Look at where you're metering off and see what the readings are that give you. And then you'll get to the stage where you'll start to look at things and understand rough ideas of what sorts of exposures you should be getting at what settings. And that'll just come over a period of time and a period of shooting. You know, you sit in one environment, you look over there and you think, well, I've got to start off with, I want to control my depth of field here. So I want to say I want to shoot at 4.5 on the f-stop for aperture. And then you'll start to think to yourself, well, I know that's going to give me around 1/500th at 200 ISO, 400 ISO, it's going to give me 1/250th and so on, and keep going that way. And you'll just get a feel for it. But use the camera as a meter now. I mean, that's the superb way of doing it. Point it at something, take a meter. Point at something else, take a meter, and then split the metering to see what you get by putting it onto manual and just tweak one setting one or the other. Go one stop one way, one stop the other.
Yeah. Just to add to that, I can't find it, right? And I think it might even be called Light Meter. It's a free app for the iPhone, which I have tested against some really expensive light meters of my own. And it's really accurate for what it is, especially as it's free and some of my light meters cost £400. If you want, and you do own an iPhone, and I'm sure a lot of camera phones have the ability to give you a light meter. I don't know. I'm sure someone must write one for Android, so we're not talking iPhone only. Then if you're worried about, or you haven't got a camera that's given you a reading that you can understand, get a light meter application. Don't go and buy a light meter because they're far too much money. But get a light meter application for your phone and then use those figures on manual and play around with them. That's another way if you already own a phone, especially an iPhone, because that's what I know about and that's what I've got a free piece of software for. Go with that. Take your meter reading off that and then play with it. But there's always options of being able to get a manual reading without having to go out and spend a fortune on a meter. So.
Teresa in the chat room has got, manual is too much work. I prefer the professional setting so I can forget about it. And then straight afterwards, she's typed, I bought the light meter app, haven't used it yet, though. But I've got it. Practice, says Nitro. Absolutely. Grant says, stuff it, go for the P. The split. Super Chicken says he starts at Q in his alphabet and also says that he is confident, spelt with a capital R. He's been on form today. Well done, Pete. Right. That's it. That's the news. That's the questions. What do we do next, normally? That's it, isn't it?
I know. I can't remember. I don't do this very often.
It's bloody Carl's show. He can't be bothered to show up now. How many weeks?
You can get me, right, on Alex G. Fox on Twitter.
And you can get me, Ewan Rankin, on at Ewan Rankin on Twitter and at ewanrankin.co.uk for commercial photography work.
Okay. We know who you are.
Yeah, we'll find you. Have a good week. See you next week. Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.